This is the NCARB podcast, where you get an inside look at licensure, regulation, and the initiatives shaping the future of architectural practice. I'm your host, Andy McIntyre, Vice President of Marketing and Communications at NCARB. And this season, we're diving into Pathways to Practice, NCARB's multi-year effort to rethink how architects become licensed.
Architecture is the hardware to the software of life, right? It is fundamentally about that interaction, and it makes life easier if we have a built environment that works.
Across 8 episodes, we'll explore how licensure got to where it is today and where it needs to go next. We talk with architects, educators, regulators, and NCARB leaders about education, experience, and the exam, and why each of those pillars is evolving.
And that portion of school where you go from conceptual to real is also really challenging. It's not something you're really gently moved into. It's kind of like you're doing something that's flowy and crazy, and all of a sudden, wait, you actually have to make this work.
You'll hear how the NCARB competency standard was developed, how research is shaping future licensure models, and what a more flexible, competency-based approach could mean for candidates from a wide range of backgrounds.
So we've seen that in our data as the number of reciprocal licenses starts to decrease a little bit, but that number of individuals who are licensed holds steady.
We also tackle the big questions. Why does licensure look the way it does today? Where do candidates face the biggest barriers? And how can we expand access without lowering standards?
Not everybody fits into the same mold. And so having different pathways to licensure, I think, is really important.
Whether you're a licensure candidate, an educator, a firm leader, or a regulator, this season offers clarity, context, and transparency into one of the most important conversations facing the profession.
Does this requirement to complete all divisions of the exam place an unfair burden on any one group or other?
This is Pathways to Practice, only on the NCARB podcast. Please follow the link in the show notes, subscribe now, and join us as we explore the future of architectural licensure.
My name is Mark R. LePage, and you are listening to Entree Architect Podcast, where each week I speak with inspiring, passionate people who share their knowledge and expertise, all to help you build a better business as a small firm entrepreneur architect. Today's guest is Jeff Lucien, partner at 45 Architecture, a firm known for thoughtful work rooted deeply in place and people. Jeff is a third-generation business owner whose path to architecture blends craft, art, and entrepreneurship. From early exposure to his grandfather's shoe shop to a lifelong practice as an oil painter, Jeff believes architecture should make an impression beyond function. His work reflects a commitment to community and to building a firm that values people over projects. This conversation is about design, business, and the tensions that shape them both. Jeff Lucien, welcome to Entree Architect Podcast.
Thanks for having me here. I'm just excited to be a part of the conversation.
Yeah, I'm excited to have this conversation. You are a business guy, I'm a business guy, and we're both architects. And so this should be an interesting conversation. I love talking about business, and specifically business and architecture. So I want to hear all about 45 Architecture and how it started and what you're doing to make it successful. But before we do that, I want to know more about you. What's your origin story? When did you discover your passion for architecture, and who or what inspired you to get started?
Yeah, absolutely. When I was young, I didn't even know what an architect did, truthfully. My parents were in the medical field, and so they knew more medical, and I knew more medical terminology than construction technology and terms. But it was really in high school, I thought I wanted to design and engineer cars and bikes and skis. Industrial engineering was what I thought I wanted to do. And my father, rightfully so, was like, well, I think you should talk to industry people who are in those fields that know a lot more than you do what they're doing. And that's what I did. So I interviewed professionals in those fields when I was in high school and figured out that engineering was maybe a little less creative than I thought it would be. And to be really at that top for, say, car design was really difficult. And so it was also a location thing. You know, where did I want to be in the region in the United States? Because there's only a few places in the country that really design vehicles and cars and bikes and things like that. So, you know, the world of architecture started to open up, and it was a nice balance between engineering and science, which I loved. You know, it has practical answers and absolute answers for the most part, right? People could debate that. But then the other side of the art side that I was really drawn to, it did have that. It had the ethereal side of architecture and what beauty is. And then it had, well, building has to stand up and, you know, repel water and things like that. So I liked the science and the art side of it. And a friend of mine, it's interesting, he was going to go into architecture. I was going to go into engineering. We switched. He's an engineer and professionally, now I'm an architect professionally. So we kind of joke about that that story that we were sitting in physics class in high school together and where we are now.
You swapped lives.
We did, yeah. So it was really, you know, my grandfather was a tinker. He owned a shoe shop that would build small miniature dollhouses for my sister. And, you know, I would say, could I have this plane? And he would build a plane out of wood and rubber bands, and it would fly around the room kind of thing. And I always loved that side of it, kind of the craftsman of just taking little pieces and building things. And so that love of creation and craft came from him. And then the drive really came from my father to figure out what I wanted to do. So
you were based in Bozeman, Montana?
Yeah. Yeah. I moved back about 10 years ago, kind of did a stint to find experience, frankly. Montana, up until about 15 years ago, was pretty quiet for architecture, in fact.
Yeah.
There were some architects here doing some great things, but it really kind of exploded in the last 10 to 15 years and afforded, you know, a lot of us had to move out of Montana to be kind of professional architects, engineers, lawyers, whatever it was. And so did my stint on the West Coast, California, Washington, and Oregon, and then moved back, was able to move back kind of 10, 15 years ago.
So you were born and raised in Bozeman?
Born and raised in Bozeman. And then, you know, I had to find my way before realizing how special this place is.
Yeah. Did you think you were going to go back, or did you think once you left, you were going to stay out on the West Coast?
I thought I would stay out, truthfully. Yeah. I've always loved kind of the energy around cities and, you know, the architecture and the movement of people and ideas, right? San Francisco is where I ended up out of school, and that was a great place for that, right? Startup cultures and, you know, big companies doing big things. And, you know, you find different values in different points of your life, right? So started a family, and raising families in Montana, there's nothing better.
Is that what drew you back? The idea that you wanted to raise a family? And
yeah, I think the appreciation of small town, you know, you can affect your small town. I wanted to get really involved in nonprofits and affect my community. I think that's one thing in a big city, it feels a bit daunting as to affect your community. In a small town, you know, as an architect, you know, I was doing custom homes and wineries in San Francisco. And I really wanted to get into a different avenue of doing more community-based work alongside, you know, building somebody's dream. But there's nothing better than watching my kids interact with a library that we just, you know, helped open last year, right?
That's cool.
That's really why I got into architecture. If it was for the money, I would have been a hedge fund manager, right? Like, and we do this for a reason. I think getting into that really paid off emotionally more than anything.
I heard you say in your intro that you were originally interested in car design. So were you a car guy? Was your family into cars? What was the inspiration for car design?
I think, you know, the old 90s Lamborghini hanging on the wall, right? Like the...
Yeah, Countach.
The Countach, right? The classic, you know, magazine fold out poster. It was started from that, but I think it's just the beauty of the sleekness and the engine. It's like engineering and art, right? I think great cars. My dad had a muscle car growing up, a 69 Mustang,
cool.
You know, cherry red. And it was that blend of engineering and design. And I really love that something is really well engineered as well as beautiful. And I think those two things are really difficult and way more difficult than people give credit for.
Yeah.
I call it kind of the iPhone revolution, where people didn't appreciate engineering and design until the iPhone came out truly. Because once it was kind of mass adoption that good design matters. And you know, I think there's always these little niches of people that have always believed that, but it's hard to prove that good design matters. And as an architect, we're constantly trying to do that, whether it's emotional or psychological. You know, there's health benefits to good design, right? But at the end of the day, you know, cost comparisons to it, you know, some people, and I get it, you know, they don't fully believe in it. And that's kind of the role that we have, is bringing people along in that journey to help them believe, you know.
When you went back to Bozeman to start your firm, in the timeline, was that the case? Did you go back to Bozeman and start the firm, or how did you get to 45?
It was a little more happenstance than that. You know, moving back, I knew I always wanted to start my own firm, and I thought it would just be me finding clients that were interested. And when I got here, it is a small community, and, you know, I grew up here, and so it was easier to plug right back in. But to move here, we were moving, my wife was pregnant, so it was like, okay, I need to land somewhere first. And a local firm was hiring at the time, and similar work that I had been doing, and it was a great fit initially. And then I think the longer I was there, the more that the itch, the scratch, the entrepreneurship itch really started to take hold. And, you know, I was jonesing for an opportunity. And I was at a wedding, a mutual friend's wedding, and Ben, my business partner, was there, and, you know, a mom of a friend, you know, it's like everybody knows each other. And it's like, oh, Ben's an architect, you should meet Ben. And I was like, oh, okay. And so we're chatting. He's like, man, you should really work for me sometime. And I said, oh, I'll work with you, but not for you, you know? And it started a conversation that they had already kind of started this firm a year prior. There was two partners at the time, just two people. And they were doing similar work, had some interest in residential and some public work. And I was like, ooh, this could be a really good fit from the business model side that they were starting to kind of kick up. And so it took about 4 or 5 months, but we got a kind of a deal together and came in and as a principal, and was able to make some waves. And I had some clients out of Portland that were interested in helping build our company with some new work. And then it was just, honestly, it was, as you know, it's convincing people that you're worth it, right? I think that's the biggest thing we've been doing over the last couple of years. That's now transitioned to people actually want to work with us for who we are versus what we say we're going to do. But, you know, it was three partners, only three employees. We were all partners. And a year later, we were able to hire two more people. And we bought out that third business partner about 6 years ago. And now we're 20, 21, 22 people. So, and we're 11 years old. So it's been an interesting entrepreneurship journey to get to where we are today. So,
how did you know Ben was the right partner?
You know, that's interesting. I think a lot of people, there's a lot of founders out there, right? Especially being in San Francisco and talking to a lot of people. Everybody in San Francisco had their work, and then they had this startup that they had this idea, right? It was a fun atmosphere because everybody had this. And there was a lot of conversations about finding founders, other founders, right? And Ben had already started this thing that was kind of interesting. And I think personality-wise, I think we were going to get along. I think what's interesting is really diving into how people work. I don't know if I took as much ownership to figure that out early on. We've had to figure that out kind of over the last 10 years of that working relationship. But it's kind of that overall attitude of how people treat each other. It's in some ways, I equate a lot of life and business to dating, right? Like,
yeah, for sure.
And there's a lot of similarities to that too, of nobody's going to be perfect. Everybody's going to have to figure it out together. And I think Ben was willing to do that. So it's been a good fit.
So originally three partners, did you have divided responsibilities or did you all do everything or did you run it like three separate firms?
Yeah, we kind of all did everything. I think we came in a bit ignorant on how that was really going to work on the roles and responsibilities, right? When you're three people, you're just like doing everything to just get the job done, right? Everybody's kind of doing their own tasks in some ways for certain projects. And then we would come together for, say, chasing a larger public project that we had to propose on and then interview. And we each had our certain strengths. And then I think as the firm grew, those individualities became heightened or that came to light more of those roles and responsibilities. And so we've even, now that we're even 21 people, we've actually gone back through and dialed in those roles a lot more. We just went through the system EOS, right? Through the book Traction.
You know Wickman?
Yep. And so we just spent the last year kind of evolving our company into that process, which has been really, I think, really helpful to create roles and have those accountability matrix aligned. Because as you get bigger, people think everybody's going to do something else, and it usually doesn't happen, right? So having that clarity is really helpful.
Do you have that clarity now between you and Ben? Do you have specific responsibilities that you each are responsible for?
Yeah, now we do. Any of that early tension, say early in building a company, a lot of it is that it's you're trying to communicate, but a lot of times you don't know what you don't know, and you don't know what you're good at in running a business, because I didn't come from running a separate business and then into this business to say, here's my strengths, here's my roles. You know, we were in our early 30s at the time. And so we're like, okay, well, I think this is important and I think that's important. And our business plan kind of constantly shifted, and then it started to work. And so we kind of leaned into that business model, but lining out those roles was really important, right? And as you grow and as each person, you start to burn out in some ways, because there was a lot of moments there where I was running around doing lots of different things that, frankly, maybe I shouldn't have been doing as part of my role, but it needed to be done, right? Like there's a new computer and a new staff person starting Monday. I have to set the computer, right? I got to install all the programs. I got to get the email set up. But, you know, I was doing that 9-10 at night the day before that person starting. And eventually that's not good for the business, right? You really have to almost protect yourself. That's something over the last 5 years I've really had to evolve into, is almost protecting my time, right? If somebody wanted a meeting, boom, I'd be available. And good and bad, I've had to say no a lot. And that's a hard lesson, because I want to help and I want to jump in and just fix things, but I can't be doing that all the time.
What other lessons did you learn on those early days? What mistakes did you make that you would have done differently if you had a second chance?
I would have spent a lot more time on those roles to say, you know, hey, what are we doing? Where are we going? It's always, hindsight's always 20/20 to say, oh, well, we're building this bigger thing. At the time, it was like, okay, if we could get to 5 people, that would be really successful. If we won this one job, that would be really successful. And we tried to spend some time on doing early retreats to have those conversations. But I don't know if I knew enough to then put enough importance on that to say, what exactly are you doing each day versus what I'm doing? Because we really need to line this stuff out so that we are successful. And I think those early conversations that are honestly really uncomfortable, personality, you know, traits come into play, people's work ethics come into play, their families come into play. But if you don't do it, it only gets worse. And I think EOS kind of pulls that out of you, that you have to do that. We did that early on, that created a different firm, and we ended up buying out that business partner 6 years ago, partly because we had to kind of go through that emotional reckoning or reconciliation of that. EOS has done that almost fine-tuning for us in the last year, but that's kind of the advice, is having those really tough, awkward conversations that keeps you up at night, and everybody has them. You gotta voice them. And the level 10 meetings that we've been having to have those issues, we just put it on the issues list and then we just talk about it. We've been able to have a lot more frank conversations than we've ever had because of that. So even creating metrics or mechanisms to have those conversations, sometimes even that's helpful.
Yeah.
I wish I would have spent more time on that.
Sometimes finding those frameworks like EOS early on is helpful, but also, you know, sometimes I think, having done this for so long and talking to so many different people, sometimes you just have to walk through the storm to get to the clear sky, right? That you have to go through the pain and learn the lessons, because you just don't know. You just don't know what you're doing.
Yep.
And you learn as you do it.
As much as you want to read and study, at the end of the day, you do have to experience it. And I think some of those struggles, those battle wounds that you carry on, gives you wisdom, and then that wisdom you can share. And I agree with you. Even if we had a system to have that, I don't know if it would have really mattered, because, you know, the ignorance is a bit helpful because you're just going in trying to figure it out. I think paying attention to it is the wisdom part, is now that you've been doing it longer and probably the other people you've talked to, it's helpful to start paying attention to those little intuition pieces that come up that you're like, maybe we should spend a little time on this. Employee development, I mean, we've looked at it all. and it's all important in its own right. But having that strong leadership is going to be helpful long term.
Yeah. So for you who are listening, definitely find a framework, right?
Yeah.
Whether it's EOS or eMyth Revisited, read something, put together some sort of framework, but don't get frustrated when the framework doesn't work, right? Because a lot of it's just a matter of doing it and seeing how it works. And then you'll come back to that later, knowing that it's there.
The other thing I would say with that is don't get hung up on the framework. A lot of times, like as entrepreneurs, we love process inherently because it's like, right, oh, I need to do this in order to do that. I get a lot of questions now of like, well, what lawyer should I have? Or what accountant should I have? Or what framework should I use? And in some ways, I'm like, just go do the work and pay attention to the framework and
right,
when you need a lawyer and when you need an accountant. But don't try to get everything set up to then build a business. I think, you know, you have to bootstrap it in some ways to say, go find the client. That is your first and only goal in some ways, and then let the other stuff feed into that. But if you don't have clients, there's no point in finding an accountant or finding a lawyer or building a framework, right?
Right.
You know, it's kind of causation. You really have to get into it.
Yeah, exactly. Let's take a quick break to say thank you to our sponsors for their support of this episode. This episode of Entree Architect Podcast is supported by WeCollabify, one of our trusted allied partners. As this community has grown over the years, one thing has become very clear to me. The partners we choose matter. Allied partners are not sponsors. They're not advertisers. They are organizations that we've taken the time to get to know, to work alongside, and to trust. They understand the real pressures of practice and the responsibility that comes with leading a small firm. WeCollabify earned that trust by helping small firm owners address a challenge that sits at the center of long-term firm health, building capacity in a way that supports people, not just projects. Their insourcing model brings skilled design, BIM, and technical professionals directly into your team. They work in your time zone, inside your systems, and part of your day-to-day workflow. That integration allows firms to add capacity when it's needed, scale with intention, and grow without sacrificing culture, leadership focus, or quality of life. If you're thinking beyond short-term fixes and focused on building a firm that lasts, I encourage you, go learn why WeCollabify is one of our trusted allied partners. Visit WeCollabify.com/EntreeArchitect to learn more. That's WeCollabify.com/EntreeArchitect. Gain lessons learned and credits earned with Arcademy, ArCat's continuing education program. Listen to popular episodes of the detailed podcast and earn AIA-approved HSW credits. Yes, you heard that right, HSW credits for episodes of detailed podcast. Listen to an episode, check out the learning objectives, and use what you've learned while listening to take the course. The program is free, it's simple, and can be found at arcat.com under the resources tab, or just go to arcat.com/arcademy. That's arcat.com/arcademy. That's arcat.com/arcademy. Please visit our sponsors today and thank them. Thank them for supporting you, the Entree Architect community. So what does 45 Architecture look like today? You mentioned that you had 20 employees somewhere around there. What type of work do you do and who do you serve?
Yeah, so we serve our surrounding community in the state at large. Montana is a fairly small population state, so a lot of the work we do travels around the state. We do, you know, fire station we're currently on. We're on a resort project, a library, community center, athletics, you know, athletic master plan for the local university here. So we do a lot of that community work. And then we also do some hospitality and custom homes. A lot of the people that we work on their homes with are people moving here. There's a lot of people still relocating to rural areas and they want the Montana lifestyle where you can be on the mountain skiing in 20 minutes and or be on a hike in 20 minutes and still get, you know, a coffee and a cocktail or operate ski kind of thing. So, and there's a large university here, large for Montana, I would say. And so, you know, I think we're 16,000 students that come into a town about, you know, 50, 55,000. So it's a big college town in some ways too. So it's, as our clients who move here say, you know, they were really looking for a town under 100,000, outdoor focused, with a university and a good airport. And we kind of hit all those four pieces. Those four things is what we see most.
Yeah. And as it grows, it changes.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. There's more architecture.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, I grew up in the New York metropolitan area, but now I live in the Charlotte region.
Yeah.
In Charlotte, in North Carolina. And when I first started coming to Charlotte to visit my brothers, and my wife's brothers were down here 30 years ago, it was a totally different place. So it was this country city.
Yeah.
And today it's this booming city and it grows. You can like physically see it growing. It's growing so fast and it's changing so rapidly. And so everything that people are moving to escape the things that they don't like, it's slowly becoming similar to the places that they're leaving. It's because it's growing so fast.
I call Montana a bit of a teenager, right? We're kind of going through our identity change right now. And it's, we're kind of hitting that tipping point where enough people are here where it's not the small town it used to be or what I grew up here, right? It just isn't. And people are still kind of holding on to that mantra and that feel and that sense of place. And so that's why I like doing community work, because it's like, if it's going to grow, how do we protect
exactly
and build that importance into those spaces so that it's going to be different, absolutely, but it might as well be really intentionally different versus just, you know, whether it's urban sprawl or, you know, placeless places that we all have experienced, those locations that have grown a lot. And it just, the downtown is kind of dead. There's no life or kind of city culture. And so that's been kind of our fight in some ways, is how to educate people that growth can be good. We just have to really make it intentional. And Bozeman has been really accepting to that. I think architecture here is more accepted than most places that are 50,000 people. So that's been the fun part, is that it's been accepted here.
What kind of marketing are you doing to get noticed? What differentiates you from the other firms in Bozeman?
Yeah, at the end of the day, it's referrals, right? I think we build really strong relationships with our clients. And, you know, these are large purchases and large decisions that people make. And they're going to ask their friends and family, and our name will get around long enough that you're like, oh, you should at least talk to Jeff, right? You should at least talk to Ben or whoever in our company. And a lot of times, if we can get in front of somebody, we can win the work. I think that's one thing that we're really strong at, is building that trust. Building very quickly with a client, which is really important, right? Like, you know, walk in the room, we're two strangers talking about maybe some similarities, but how do I get somebody to trust me to take a large sum of money and design something that they're truly going to love and be a good steward of it, and then be an advocate for them long term? So that's, I think, been really successful. I've always been fascinated by ads and how, you know, the traditional kind of 90s advertisements that I grew up with, I think are so fascinating. You know, design-wise, the old Nike ads, you know, Jordan ads.
The Countach poster.
Yeah, exactly. It all kind of comes back to that.
Yeah.
And people have a natural attraction to that stuff. And so I think we've always been a bit forward on our website and our social media and any aspect we can in order to represent ourselves in a certain way. I think you can curate that experience, but you have to follow it up. And it's a bit of a give and take, that you don't want your marketing to outshine your work, because that's not good either. If you can't deliver on your advertisements, then you're false advertising, right? It goes back to the old magazine ads. But if you can deliver that, and in some ways your ads and your website isn't fulfilling that, that's not good either, because then people are like, yeah, they're really good, but are they worth it, right? And you want the value of your design, because that's one thing I think is really interesting, is that value of design is a bit of perception, right? Architects are classically underpaid in the industry, at least our industry. We complain about it internally to each other that we're underpaid, but it is a brand, right? There's certain architects that get paid very, very well. And there's certain architects that don't. And so understanding the why behind the cost structures is a value proposition, right? So I think that's a very interesting inflection point that I like to needle into. And I don't think there's a secret. I think the secret is you have to raise the level of work and the experience and the value to your customers as much as that what you show the outside public, and do those together and raise one and then raise the other. So
totally. It takes both. You have to do great work, and then you have to let the world know you do great work.
Right. Unfortunately, it is how the world works. You have to self-advertise because, you know, you can be very conservative and not. I interned with a contractor in high school, just really using a shovel and just digging things. And he was like, oh, we really don't like to advertise. It's only word of mouth. And I agree to that idea if you're a small town. But as you get bigger and bigger, a lot of people are like, oh, I would have used you. You guys do great work. I just never knew about you. And that's what I don't want to have happen.
Yeah. Before, when you were describing the firm and the community work that you did, my thought was core principle, stewardship. And then you said the word stewardship.
Yeah.
It sounds like you're very intentionally building a brand.
Yes.
What are some of the other core principles that you're using in your brand to identify who you are to the people who want to work with you?
So we actually went through our core values over the last year, and we did a survey to our staff and said, what do you want to be known for? And what do you think 45 Architecture embodies? And so we got three of those terms or sentences from everybody. And then we really compiled them into what we believe and then curated that list and honed it down into four or five main core values. You know, craft is one of them. Approachable and coachable, I think, is huge. You have to be approachable. Yeah, that stewardship is one of them. Guard the brand, protect the culture, I think, is one. You know, whether you're out in public, whether you're speaking like here today, it's all part of that embodiment of who we are. So yeah, we've really tried to evolve those over the last year and then use them even when we hire. So I send out a survey to potential staff and I say, here's our core values. I want to see how we line up because this is what we care about. And if your core values don't align, it's not going to be a good fit, right? And so we actually do that as part of our hiring process now as well.
Yeah, that's a great tip for sure. It's not only about branding. And that branding process is not only about clients, it's also about bringing the right people into your studio.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. Because if you're not bringing people along and they just have a different core value, and it's just not going to be a good fit long term. I mean, whether we're owners of the company or staff, and everybody's got to figure out their own core value, right? And that does take time and experience, right? Like grass is always greener. And so, you know, this is the sixth place I've worked. I've interned a couple places and then was fortunate to have employment at a couple other places around those different states. And so I've got a good breadth of different how firms are run. And we just wanted to take the best parts from all these places and really evolve it.
Looking back at those early days when you and Ben first started and what you've accomplished today, what would you say you're most proud of?
What I'm most proud of. You know, I'm most proud of the accessibility and the attitude that we had as owners to our staff and clients. I think people say they care and that they listen, but I think there's this excitement and caring that I think we really embodied, where we really wanted to be involved in that life of whatever they were creating. And it became very emotional in some ways. And that's kind of good and bad. Mm-hmm. It's bad because, you know, when projects don't go well or a client, you know, it's not a good fit long term, you know, you take that very personal. But it's also that kind of Montana attitude, right? We always say Montana's like the experience of if you drive off the road in a snowstorm, that somebody's going to stop and get you out. And it doesn't matter who they are. It doesn't matter what kind of car they drive or what kind of car you drive. It's just neighbor helping out neighbor. And I think that's the attitude that we carried early on, is kind of what would a neighbor do, you know? Mm-hmm. And we loved it, right? And we still do. I think a lot of clients that come to us just get really excited because we are personally excited about their journey and their vision and carry them kind of through, you know, we're right next to Yellowstone Park. So the analogy is like, be that tour guide to that vision and guide them along the process.
Yeah, that's awesome. Looking ahead, what's the future look like for 45 Architecture? What are your plans?
Yeah, absolutely. We're really intentional in that, right? So through our planning, we have our 1-year plan, our 3-year plan, and our 10-year plan. that intentional growth is what we're really striving for, say, this year. Our, this year is really to be intentional in the clients that we take on. You know, in 21, we all had lots of clients and we all probably burnt ourselves out in some ways. And so now we're kind of reflecting to say, how can we do a better job per client instead of more clients in general? And so it's that intentional growth or that system growth, right? Whether it's budget systems, customer service systems. So that's kind of the next year. I think what we want to do as a larger group, I'd love to bring in an intentional growth on homes in different states. We're working on probably homes in 3 or 4 different states right now. I'd love to grow that over the next 3 years to 8 to 10 different states. And I think we can do it. And then I think it's just building our leadership team. You know, I'm in early to mid 40s and we really want to have our succession plan in place in the next 3 to 5 years to really build that leadership team and to start delegating even more.
That 10-year plan, how big do you imagine you'd get?
It's not employees. I think it's quality of work. Mm-hmm. If we grow, it's growing intentionally. I think we wouldn't want to be over 20 to 30 people per location. So I think we would look at a different location if it came to that and we were successful. Because it does change the dynamics. You know, I've worked for firms that were 200 people, and you almost know less people at 200 people than you do when you're a 20-person office. And I love that small workshop. We have this really cool yearbook we have every year called Workshopped. And we kind of create, you know, that process that we do in that year within this book, this annual. And I love that feeling, that crafted feeling. And it's really hard to sustain when you're, you know, 100, 200 people. And each office, I think, can have their own space. But that's kind of the intentional growth we have for this, you know, 1 to 10 years.
Yeah, I love it. As we wrap up here, you are obviously a business owner, an entrepreneur, interested in business. So you've actually studied it as well.
Yeah.
You have thousands of architects. Lots of them are business owners listening right now. What would you say is the one thing that a small firm architect can do today to build a better business for tomorrow?
Yeah. As a small business is being really, and this is kind of a blanket statement, but I think being really intentional in anything you do and have it be really, really good, right? I think the tendency as an entrepreneur is just, oh, I got to put out all these fires. But start lining those out into a task list and take the top three and make those really, really good. If it's your website, you know, there's plenty of, the accessibility to information now is extreme, right? Like you can look at any architect stuff on almost any platform. And in some ways, just take that inspiration and build your own website and make it amazing. Even if it's 2 projects, I think so often people want to tell the whole story.
Yeah, I agree.
The consumer can never consume the whole story. You got to tell the snippet that you want to say, right? It's like portfolios or anything else. And then from there, you just go on to the next item to say, you know, the whole thing of a mission statement. I think that's good. But I think it's just like, what is your differentiator in the market? Right? I think what is going to make you special? And thinking a lot about that, Simon Sinek's like Start With Why, I think is a great book. And then to keep telling that story, Story Brand 2.0, I'm reading that right now. I mean, a lot of these books are really great resources to then start getting your brain thinking about how to apply it to architecture. And then taking that very intentionality to little micro movements of your company to then move that along, right? And then obviously as the necessity comes up, right, you need a lawyer, good and bad, then go find the best lawyer you can, right? And that will keep evolving your community of assets forward. And eventually people are like, well, how did you get to where you are? And you're like, man, it's a lot of small moves. It's a lot of small moves. So I guess a lot of small moves is my advice.
I love it. His name is Jeff Lucene. He is the principal and owner of 45 Architecture and Interiors. If you'd like to go check them out, you can go to 45arch.com. That's the website, 45arch.com. You should go to the website. They do great work. And I love the stewardship. I love that you are very focused on your community, that you've gone back to Bozeman, and that you are intentional about the work that you do so it doesn't grow out of control, right? There are people like you in Bozeman who have that family connection to the generations of Bozeman. And so you are stewarding the architecture that's being developed there and the development. It's an important role that many architects should look to you as a role model. So thank you for doing that.
Absolutely.
And thank you for coming by here and sharing your knowledge at Entree Architect Podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Mark. Appreciate it.
If you enjoyed this episode of Entree Architect Podcast, please share a link with a friend, because that's how we've continued to grow and serve thousands more small firm architects just like you. Thank you to our sponsors for this episode. Links to the sponsors and all the resources we discussed today, they are all available in the show notes for this episode at entrearchitect.com/podcast. Entree Architect is a proud member of the Gable Media Network. It's the multimedia network moving the architecture, engineering, and construction industries forward through the power of storytelling. You can earn AIA continuing education credits by listening to select episodes of this podcast and many others at gablemedia.com/members. And if you are a small firm architect, listen up. Join us today at Entree Architect Network. It's the worldwide community for entrepreneur architects. We've been around since 2012, and our basic level is now free to join. Yes, you can join Entree Architect Network for free. And that gives you access to valuable business resources and our global community of architects. And you can upgrade anytime for live coaching, AIA approved training, and mastermind support. So visit entrearchitect.com to learn more and to get started. My name is Mark R. LePage. Thank you for listening to the Entree Architect Podcast. Love, learn, share. Attention architects and creative minds, get ready to supercharge your brand with Build Your Brand, the podcast that's unlocking the secrets of branding success for creatives. Hey there, it's Mark R. LePage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my friend, architect marketing expert, Jeff Eccles at Build Your Brand podcast, where he explores the captivating stories of the world's top brands and transforms their lessons into powerful moves for small firm architects and creatives like you. In season one, Jeff shares the thrilling tale of Southwest Airlines, where he dissects their journey to the summit and distills it into strategies tailor-made for you.
It's important to keep in mind that companies like Southwest compete in the real world, just like you, and face real-world challenges, just like you. You might be surprised at how similar those challenges are to the struggles that you grapple with on a day-to-day basis.
Don't miss out on your blueprint for success. Subscribe, tune in, and let's build your brand together.
You may have noticed that the very best brands in the world are also known for having somewhat unique corporate cultures. That's often the glue that holds everything together when they encounter those rough spots.
We don't do it because it inconveniences the passengers to whom we are primarily dedicated, the short haul, frequent flyer.
Follow the link in the show notes to subscribe to Build Your Brand today. Remember, no matter the size, the journey's the same. Your brand's journey to the top starts here.
Imagine earning continuing education credits while doing exactly what you're doing right now. Well, you can. Gable Media has revolutionized the way you earn your continuing education credits with a groundbreaking approach. Forget running around town and scouring the internet for credit-worthy courses. Fulfill your CE requirements effortlessly by listening to engaging podcasts just like the one you're listening to now. Our podcasts are designed to educate, entertain, and inspire, all in a user-friendly environment. But wait, there's more. Architects, Gable Media is also approved as an AIA Continuing Education Services provider. Upon completion, we handle everything, from reporting your hours directly to the AIA to storing your certificates in your personal Gable Media profile for your self-reporting needs. So follow the link in the show notes and start earning your credits in the most innovative and entertaining way possible with Gable Media.